Any questions, comments so far?
I know there's a link between friendship and being in community.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to address the community aspect directly?
Okay. So you're saying that there's a link between being friendship and community. And will I address community directly? Can we just talk a little bit about community right now? And the role of friendship and how that relates to this. When you live in community, and by the way, we are always living in community. Because we always live in relationship to every other sentient being in this entire universe. We think that we can isolate ourselves. I'm living alone. I lock the doors at night. I live alone. I'm not in relationship with anybody. Or, you know, people say to me, oh, you're going to the monastery. Aren't you abandoning the world? Huh? How do you ever abandon the world? Where do you ever go where you're not living in relationship to all living beings, whether you know them or don't know them? It's true, isn't it? Yeah? Because we are all interdependent. You know the thing about the butterfly flapping its wings in Singapore, and then that influences one thing which influences another thing, and, you know, eventually affects our life directly. But if you think of all living beings in this universe, you know, in some way we're interdependent like that. We influence each other. And so, of course, some people we're closer to, some people we're more distant from, but we always live in society, we always live in community. So sometimes I hear people talk like, I'm ending this relationship. This relationship is over. And I go, huh? How do you end a relationship? Because we always exist in relationship to everybody. You're changing the relationship. Okay? But changing a relationship is different than ending a relationship. Because we're always related to everybody. You get what I mean? In America, we like to pretend we're not. Yeah? And we watch in our homes. And our affluence, I think, has really affected us in a harmful way, because we think that caring about children means giving them everything they want materially. And we think happiness means having everything we want materially. No? So people in a family never watch television together. Even they're glued into the television, which I think is horrendous to start with. They can't even do it together in the same room. Everybody has to have their own TV. Everybody has to have their own computer, their own iPod, you know. People hardly see each other when they live in the house. And even they see each other, they're always plugged in with earphones behind a computer with a newspaper. Huh? And you see people walking down the streets, and they have one cell phone in this hand and another one in that hand. And, you know, I mean, you've seen it, how people are talking to two people with two different phone lines at the same time. And, you know, not knowing how to relax and relate to real human beings. So we think that we are separate. You know, we have our own this and our own that. But, you know, we're always relating to everybody. And that feeling of separation, I think, creates a lot of unhealthy mental patterns. So we think, I'm separate from everybody, so I've got to care about number one, which is me. Now, we're very individualistic. So we all want to be an individual, but in a conforming way. Don't we? We want to make our own individual stamp, but as long as it's within the purview of what we think other people think we should be. Somehow we don't. We've lost touch with ourselves. We've lost touch with other people. I think too much technology, you know, misuse of technology. It's not the fault of technology. It's the fault of how we misuse it. And then just create this thing of, you know, I am this isolated person that I've got to take care of. And forget everybody else, because it's a dog-eat-dog society. And we've adapted this whole thing of Darwinism, you know, to our social structure. And I'm not convinced that Darwinism is really the accurate description of the physical evolution, let alone societal evolution. Yeah. But we're firmly convinced that it's dog-eat-dog, and we've got to conquer over the other person. And we have to use other people to gain our own advantage. But if you actually look at it, what is it that allows various species to continue to exist? It's when they cooperate with each other. Okay? The Abbey, we have these enormous anthills. It's incredible. These huge anthills. 1,000 billions of ants, it seems like. But they're all working together for their common good. No? And so as a result, they have this, you know, probably to them what appears to be quite a palatial home. And it's because they cooperate and they help each other. And I know bees are having a hard time this year, but they usually cooperate and help each other. That's how they stay alive. If we look at ourselves as human beings, we've got to cooperate with each other to stay alive. I don't know about you, but I don't know how to grow my own food. I don't know how to grow cotton and process it and make cloth. I know how to sew, but I don't know how to make a sewing machine. I don't know how to build a place to live in. So when we look around us, everything we have, everything we use, all comes from other living beings. We, you know, we're so related to them. When I was in New York last week, I just arrived and I was eating dinner before I gave the talk, and then I looked out the window and, you know, it's quite different from where I live because, you know, we grow lots of hay and pine trees and fir trees, and New York grows asphalt and concrete. And I looked out the window and I thought, wow, what does it take to get enough food into this city every day to feed all the people who live here? Because all the food that is consumed in the city, it's not grown there in the city. It's coming from somewhere else. How do they even transport so many tons of food every day into such a small area? It's beyond my comprehension when I think about it. And yet every day, you know, most of the people there have enough to eat. Some people go hungry, but most people have food. And it's all due to the kindness of other living beings. And yet we hardly ever think of our food coming due to the kindness of others and, you know, because of relationship with others. We just think it's my money and I'm going to the store and buying my food. Yeah, we hardly think to say thank you to the people who operate the store, or thank you to the truck drivers, or thank you to the, you know, the truck drivers who transport the food, or thank you to the construction workers who build the roads that the truckers use. No? We hardly think to say goodbye, thank you to the garbage collectors who take away the stuff we don't want. But we always are living in relationship with these people. So we always are there in community, aren't we? Yeah? We're always in community. And so if we open our eyes, then the people we interact with every day become our community. And we really appreciate them and feel close to them. And instead of just walking by them as if they were a robot, you know, we walk by them with a smile and with an acknowledgement of their humanity. And even when you see little animals and insects and you know, to acknowledge here's some living being. Yeah, little dogs on the streets or cats running around. We have a lot of birds here and some frogs and, you know, there might be some ants and later on there will be mosquitoes and, you know, all sorts of different sentient beings around here. And they all want to be happy and be free of suffering and we share the environment with them. In some cases, their environment that they share with us. If you look at it, there's probably more insects on this piece of land than there are human beings. So why do we think that we human beings possess the land and the insects just come along with it? Maybe it's we should think that it's the property of the insects and they allow us to come here and disturb their homes and, you know, do our thing here. It's a matter of perspective, isn't it? We could see it either way. So, you know, when we change our mind and our attitude like this, then our feeling of community changes. So when you're riding on a bus or in a subway, that's your community at that period of time. And those people are close to each other and depend on each other. I had one friend who, I forget what year it was, I think it was in the 80s when the electricity went out in New York, remember? Mm-hmm. And she was in a subway when the electricity went out. And she said that everybody in the subway held hands and walked along the subway track together until they got to some place where they could go up. Isn't that an incredible story of community? Yeah, because often on subways, those are people, you know, you don't even want to, you hardly even look at and treat as human beings, let alone, you know, necessarily even want to be with for any period of time. And yet that's a community and how much they helped each other and how much they needed and depended upon each other when they were stuck underground. So there's always community around us. And there's so many ways to just participate with kindness, even to people, even with people who are strangers. So the person at the checkout counter in the grocery store to say thank you. And the person, you know, who's loading the food on the grocery store. You know, the young kids who do that for minimum wage and do we ever stop and say thank you so much? I really appreciate your putting the food on the shelf so that it's easy for me to find. I travel a lot, you know, so I'm in the airport bathrooms and I try and thank the people who clean the bathrooms. Because if they didn't do that, well, you know, I benefit from what they're doing. So you see, we make community by our awareness of other living beings as really being living beings and not just being automatons. Okay? Then, there's the intentional communities that we set up. Okay? So there might be the community of the family, which is a community that is in dire stress right now. There's other intentional communities. You might have a roommate, that's your community. I live in a monastic community. So, you know, there's various kinds of communities that we may live in. When you're at work, the people you work with are your community. We often think that we want a community of people around us of just who are our friends. Yeah, let my community be friends. Well, in an office, the people you work with aren't necessarily your friends. Sometimes you may not like them, you may have different interests from them, but they are your community. And so at that time, we have to stretch our mind beyond this thing of I like and I don't like and be close to me and get away from me. And we have to try and create some kind of good feeling and good relationship with everybody who happens to be in our workplace community, whether we like them or don't like them. You know? So we might have to put out some energy and try and find a topic that we can talk with them about that is of interest to both of us. I don't know about you, but I love hearing people's stories. Yeah? And I love talking to elderly people. I feel so bad the way our society treats senior citizens, because they have a certain kind of wisdom and experience and life history that I think is just incredible. And I love asking them about their lives and what they did in their life and what they saw, because a lot of what they experienced directly is only stuff that I've read about. Yeah, I love being in other countries with people, you know, who are different. I like being with people of different social classes. This last week I spent in prisons in North Carolina and Virginia. It was fantastic. I mean, I so enjoyed being with those people and getting to know them. Yeah. And so if we have some kind of curiosity about people and willingness to open ourselves up, we can find some way to create a closer relationship with everybody and some way to bond with everybody. In a monastic situation, you know, people have such funny ideas about monasticism. You know, they think you're leaving the world and you're leaving society, and they think that you just live peaceful lives. They don't know that your attachment and resentments and opinions come with you, you know. So they don't think, or they think that everybody in the monastery, you know, you have the same haircut, you have the same clothes, you do the same thing at the same time, so you must all have the same personality. Wrong. Yeah, it's very interesting living in a monastic community, because you wind up living with people who, if you lived on the outside, you would probably not associate with. You know, people have such different personalities. And here you are, you wind up living with them. And so it's not like at a workplace. At a workplace, you don't like somebody, you go home. Yeah, you're... forget that person. In a monastery, you know, you do everything with that person that you don't like. Yeah, they're right there all the time, day and night. Yeah, and so it's very good for your spiritual practice, because you have to find some way of opening your heart to that person. Yeah, and you have to have some way of, you know, making it so that you can get along with them, because if you go through the thing of trying to change them and getting mad at them, that does not function very well in a community. So it's quite a growing situation. So living in community, you know, those kinds of intentional communities, we usually think of it as, I'm going to surround myself by the people I like. Yeah, and then when I live with the people I like, then I'll be happy, then I'll grow, I'll mature. That's not correct. Okay? It's when we live with all different sorts of people, and also when we live with people that we don't like, those are the people who stretch us, who make us grow, who make us mature. Okay? So we need those people. And they're the ones often that help us grow the most. I'll tell you my Sam story. Love this story. So I didn't think I had a problem with anger when I was younger. I just thought that I was right and other people were wrong and they needed to change. But I didn't have a problem with anger. Okay. When they got mad at me, their anger was unfair and unjust. But when I got upset with them, it was really quite reasonable because they were wrong and they needed to change. Okay, so I had no idea how opinionated I was, how much difficulty with anger I had. So my teacher, because I'm a bit hard-headed, you know, he couldn't just come up and say, you know, children, you have a problem with anger, you have to work on it. No, he didn't do that. What he did is he sent me to live in Italy with some macho Italian men. Okay? So it was at a Dharma center. And I was not only living with these macho Italian men, but I was the disciplinarian of the Sangha, the community of monastics, and a lot of these macho Italian men were the people in the community. So they didn't like very much having a woman in charge. And then I was also the spiritual coordinator of the center, which is next to the director, maybe the highest position, so a lot of them didn't like that. And one of them was the director, and you know. So anyway, we didn't get along very well. And I was not able to laugh at myself, and so they really picked up on that, and they teased me mercilessly. So of course I took it all very seriously, because they meant it. You know. And then they did all these obnoxious things that I could tell you. Oh, on and on about all these horrible things they did. Meanwhile, I was just sweet and cheerful and innocent. Easy to get along with, right? Isn't that how we always see it when we have a problem with other people? We're easy to get along with, sweet, kind, flexible. They're opinionated, wrong, stubborn, dumping on us. Okay, so that was the situation. It was all them. Nothing had nothing to do with me. But I was getting angry, and kind of once you're around Buddhism enough, you realize that when you get angry, that your mind is in a distorted state, and you've got to do something about it. So there's this book by Shantideva, one of the 8th century great Indian sages, called Guide for Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And chapter 6 is all about patience. Patience is the antidote to anger. Patience doesn't mean just enduring something. It means being able to have a calm mind in the confront of suffering or pain. So in the daytime, I would quarrel with these obnoxious people, and at night, I would go in and look up Shantideva chapter 6 and try and calm down. And then the next day, I'd go and do the same thing, get mad at them, and then come back home and try and calm down with Shantideva. That's how this book, Working with Anger, got written, you know. It's completely plagiarized from Shantideva. And it got written simply because I had to become familiar with the techniques he taught, otherwise I was going under. Okay? So, at one point I wrote to my teacher and I said, Lama, these people are making me miserable. They're making me create so much negative karma by getting angry. My negative karma is their fault. You know, can I leave? And I wrote to Lama, can I go somewhere else? And Lama wrote back and he said, oh, yes, dear, we'll talk about it. I'll be there in 6 months. I thought, oh, how am I ever going to make this, you know? Make it through. Anyway, I did. And when I finally got permission to leave, I went back to Nepal. And so I was at the monastery where another one of my teachers was. And I went up to visit him. And so we're sitting, you know, on the top of the house in Nepal, which is on a hill, looking over this valley. And it's so peaceful and quiet. And I'm so glad to be out of here. And Rinpoche looks at me and says, who's kinder to you, the Buddha or, we'll call him Sam. Sam was the one who was the director who I really had problems with. So who's kinder to you, the Buddha or Sam? And I thought, what kind of question is that? You know, and I said, well, of course, the Buddha is much kinder to me. you know, the Buddha leads me on the path to enlightenment. How can I ever repay that kind of kindness? And Rinpoche looked at me, kind of like, haven't gotten it yet. And then he went on to explain how Sam, this macho Italian man, was actually, in fact, kinder to me than the Buddha. Why? Because if I wanted to become a fully enlightened Buddha myself, I need to have the bodhicitta, that aspiration to become enlightened for the benefit of all beings. We generate that aspiration based on all living beings. If we leave one living being out of that, I want to attain enlightenment for everybody else except that one who I can't stand. If we do that, there's no way for us to become fully enlightened. Okay? So bodhicitta, that altruistic intention has to be towards every single living being. Okay? So that means if I left Sam out, I was actually hindering my own spiritual progress. And Rinpoche then explained to me that you can't practice. That was one part of it. Okay. Another part of it is if I wanted to become fully enlightened, he explained, then one of the practices of that you do to become fully enlightened is you perfect far-reaching patience. That ability to remain calm in the confront of harm or criticism or pain. And we can only develop patience when somebody harms us. So Rinpoche said, the Buddha doesn't harm you. The Buddha is kind. You can't develop patience with the Buddha. But you need to develop patience in order to become a Buddha yourself. So you need people like Sam. Because if you don't have people like him, you can't develop patience. Without patience, you can't become fully enlightened. So he said, in fact, Sam is kinder to you than the Buddha. I'm kind of going, was not what I expected from my disappointment with Rinpoche. I had expected some sympathy. You know, but he knows Sam. Sam's one of his disciples. I expect him to say, oh, I know Sam is very difficult to work with and many people have problems with him. And you did very well practicing. I know that he really was hard on you, but you did very well and I appreciate everything you did working at the center. And that's not what he said to me. He said, Sam is kinder to you than all the Buddhas and you need him. Okay, so when we live in community, the people that we don't like are actually very important people to us because those people help us to grow in ways that other people cannot help us to grow. So if you think in your life of, you know, some painful incident that you had with somebody, or a painful relationship you had with somebody, looking back on it now, did you learn things from that experience that you would not have learned otherwise? You made it through that experience. You didn't die. It didn't kill you. You made it through. Did you come out stronger in some way from having had that experience? Did you learn something important about yourself? Maybe it was something not so pleasant to learn about yourself, but something that was important to learn about yourself so that you could change and grow and improve. Yeah? So when we look back on those painful experiences that involve those people, we actually have to say thank you. Put our palms together and say thank you. Because you taught me something that I would not have learned otherwise. Lama Yeshe one time was one of my first teachers. He was a young monk at Sarajay Monastery in 1959. 59 was when there was the abortive uprising against the communist Chinese occupation in Lhasa, Tibet. And it was at that time that His Holiness the Dalai Lama fled and came into India, followed by tens of thousands of Tibetans. And they haven't been able to go back since 59. Anyway, Lama was a young monk. He was in his 20s then, studying at Sara. And when turbulence broke out in the city, Lama told us that, you know, most of the monks just took a bag of sampa, that's their ground barley flour, and their cup. Yeah, any good Tibetan monk at that era never went anywhere without their cup, because your cup was your teacup, your bowl, your everything. They went into the mountains and they expected to stay a few days and then things would calm down and they would come back. But things didn't calm down, and when they heard that His Holiness left, then they decided to flee as well. And so, as this, you know, young person in his 20s, Lama became a refugee. They got into India, you know, from the high plateaus of Tibet where there's very little bacteria and virus, into the Indian plains where there's lots of germs. And Nehru was very kind. He was Prime Minister of India at that time. He welcomed the Tibetans as refugees. India, of course, has its own problems. So they put the Tibetan, most of the monastics, the monks, they put in Baksa, which was an old British POW camp. In the movie 7 Years of Tibet, some of you may have seen that. Remember when Heinrich Herr was imprisoned in a British camp, you know, because he was a German citizen. That was the POW camp that later became where the Tibetan refugees, the monastics, were put. So Lama was there as a refugee, you know. They had very little to eat. A lot of their friends were dying. They got sick. You know, eventually as time went by, circumstances changed. He wound up opening a monastery in Kathmandu. And then he began having all these Western students. You know, those of us who just kind of showed up. And when Lama was telling us this story, you know, of how he had become a refugee and about his life, he put his hands together like this and he said, "I really have to thank Nase Tong." Yeah, he said, "I have to thank Nase Tong, because otherwise I would have stayed in Tibet, I would have gotten my Geshe degree, I probably would have become spoiled by people's offerings. But because I had to become a refugee and go through these difficulties, it made me really learn the value of Dharma practice and the preciousness of Buddha's teachings." Mm-hmm. So it was quite powerful. Mm-hmm. Now, can you imagine saying thanks to Mao Zedong for making you a refugee? So, you know, we've gone through difficulties in our lives and in relationships, but we've always survived and we've learned, and different things have happened and we've grown. So if we look at it that way, then we, you know, we have to say thank you to those people and appreciate what they did. And not just get locked into you know, community is only nice people where I'm going to live happily ever after. But community helps us to grow in many ways. And, you know, what we are very slow to realize, at least I am slow to realize, is that the people who challenge me and the people who don't like me are some of the ones who help me to grow the most. Yeah. Whereas the people who are, you know, kind of, "Oh, you're so sweet, you're so wonderful," they just cause my ego to, you know, go bonkers and become more unsubdued than it already is. That's a little bit about community. Hmm? Okay, why don't we just sit quietly for a couple of minutes, think about what we just talked about, yeah? So spend a few minutes and think about the kindness that you received from somebody who harmed you and how you grew, and try and, you know, open your mind and really let yourself experience that kindness and appreciate that person for what they did. So in this meditation, we're thinking about something. You're not watching your breath, but you're taking a life situation and applying what you just heard to it.